Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCrit Smackback. It's the first Smackback from the lectures from Smack Gold. And the lecture I'm going to be smacking back today is my friend Simon Carley's What to Believe and When to Change. Now, I wasn't able to attend this lecture when it was originally going on. I was in an alternative session, but all sorts of MCritters came up to me and said, oh my God, Simon Carley's basically throwing the gauntlet down in front of you. And so I was eagerly anticipating getting to listen to this lecture when it was published. And I listened to it yesterday, and it was fantastic. It's thought-provoking. Simon's one of the best lecturers in emergency medicine. He makes you think. I do disagree with some of the points that Simon's made, and I want to go through a few of them because I think they're truly germane to the idea of what we do in critical care and resuscitation. If you haven't heard Simon's talk yet, go over to the St. Emlyn site or come over to the mcrit.org show notes for this week, because you're not going to understand a single thing I'm talking about unless you listen to Simon's talk first. And I advise looking at the video version, because watching him and his slides is really adds to the experience. After listening to any lecture, you should ask yourself, what is the major take-home point from this talk I've just heard? And I think if you had to summarize Simon's talk, you could do so by the old heuristic bandied about by countless attendings and consultants through the years, which is never be the first or the last to adopt any new therapy. And as a heuristic, as a rule of thumb, it's not bad. If you followed this throughout your career, you'd probably do okay. Not wonderfully, not horribly, but okay. And if this is really what Simon was preaching, then it really is a lecture that would inspire mediocrity. Now, I'm not insulting Simon, because I know in this regard, Simon doesn't practice what he preaches. He doesn't wait till far too long has gone by before adopting new ideas, new concepts. Simon's not hanging out until forced to adopt new technology. Simon's one of the smartest evidence-based practitioners in emergency medicine. Simon's an early adopter, whether he chooses to brand himself or not. But let's go deeper into the theories that the lecture was predicated on. There's a lot of talk on these various classes of innovators, early adopters, laggards, etc. And you really need to know where this comes from to truly understand it. When I was in college, I read a book called Diffusion of Innovations. It was by Everett Rogers, and he talked about how new ideas, new innovations get taken up by a population. And what he put forth, and it's based on the work of others as well, is that you can make a bell-shaped curve for the adoption of a new idea by a population. And this is where the separations that Simon spoke about came from. And you basically have the innovators, the inventors, the ones who are creating the new ideas in the first place, and then the early adopters, the ones who are taking up the idea before it's hit the mainstream. The early majority, the late majority, and the laggards. And for each of these, there's various parts of their personality and the way they approach new ideas and what they do for those new ideas that's distinct for each of those classes. Now, Simon didn't delve into these, but I think it's worth doing so for a little bit. Now, obviously, without innovators, you're not going to have any new ideas. You're not going to have any new techniques. So we need them. I think that's self-evident. The early adopters are interesting. You see, the early adopters take these new inventions, these new ideas, and they play with them. They translate them. They make them usable. And between the early adopters and the early majority is what's called the chasm. And this chasm, unless bridged, will never allow a new idea to be taken up by the rest of the population, because the early majority is open to new ideas, but they want to wait until it's actually in a usable form, until it's actually had the kinks worked out, until someone else has vetted the idea. And that's not a bad place to be. That's where you'd be if you use that heuristic of never be the first or last to adopt a new technology. Now, the late majority, on the other hand, there's some pejorative aspects to the late majority. See, in general, the late majority is not utterly opposed to adopting new ideas, but they don't have the skill set necessarily to do it on their own. They need some help. They need someone else to really break it down into bite-sized pieces. And so, for instance, the late majority would be your grandparents getting an iPhone. Yeah, they're all keen to try this newest fad of the young people. But if you just gave them the phone, they're not going to be able to do anything. You have to sit there and write on little index cards how to make their mail work and how to actually use the phone. And there's nothing wrong with that. And then the laggards, well, those people really do have an issue. They're head in the sand folks, or they are just sticking with their ideas because they don't want to lose the intellectual connection they had to their beliefs. And those folks really should be chastised. But Simon did a lot of chastising of the early adopters, and the ammunition he used to shoot down those early adopters, well, it wasn't evidence against early adoption. It was evidence against bad early adoption, against people who should not be early adopters if they are doing the things that Simon spoke about. And this is really the key, is you need innovation, you need early adoption, but you need to do it right, you need to do it well. And the strawman arguments against these folks made are not a condemnation of innovation and early adoption as a whole. So that brings up the next point I want to make, which is what separates good early adopters from bad ones, from dangerous early adopters. And in Simon's lecture, he lambasted people who filter new evidence through their beliefs. In fact, he made those people seem irrational. He made those people seem unaware. I would argue just the contrary. What separates good early adopters, good early majority from the dangerous ones is the filtration through their existing beliefs. This is not an irrational subconscious process. It is a necessary, absolutely conscious process. It's Bayesian assimilation. You can't take a new piece of evidence and approach it tabula rasa. That is where the danger comes in. Instead, you must approach each new technology, each new idea, each new piece of evidence with a bedrock, with a foundation of your existing learning, your existing clinical experience, all of the things up until this point that you've gleaned and processed, and only then do you approach a new piece of evidence and see how it relates to what you already believe. This is what separates good and bad early adopters, is the degree to which they've built a belief structure, and that belief structure is sound. This is why I counsel my residents, my registrars, early in their career to not be early adopters. They don't have that huge foundation of belief in order to filter new evidence, and they can be dangerous when they adopt new technologies too early. Now, Simon gives many examples throughout his talk, but I would argue the examples he gives supports my viewpoint and not the one that he's putting forth. For instance, Simon put out a RCT that stated video laryngoscopy is ineffective and not useful. But that's not how I see it at all. You see, the randomized control trial that Simon put up was not a randomized control trial on video laryngoscopy. It was a randomized control trial on hyperangulated blades. And if you were in the midst of all these new technologies, if you had taken up all of the available ones and tried them and actually experimented with them in the lab on mannequins, and then tried the ones you felt were good on your patients, you would have appreciated long before the publication of this randomized controlled trial that hyperangulated blades are ineffective, less than ideal. And you would have been talking about that in the social media sphere for 2 years before there was a publication of a randomized controlled trial stating that they don't improve mortality, and that they probably lead to a longer time in intubation. When you listen to Rich Levitan, he was talking about this in his course. I had as well. And this is the key, that you cannot embrace new ideas or technology unless you're willing to put the time in to establish your belief structure, unless you're willing to read everything available, try every piece of new technology before adopting it to see how it fits in, to understand the complexities. Simon mentioned the TTM trial, and it was like a stab in the heart when Simon put the TTM trial as a destruction of our belief structure in the use of post-arrest hypothermia, because it didn't strike me that way at all. And this, I think, is the truly distressing part of the lecture, because this is not how new ideas should be received. When the original hypothermia trials were published, based on existing belief, I think they were the care we should be giving our patients. And then when I heard through my friends that Niklas Nielsen was engaging in a new study to compare mild hypothermia to the existing moderate hypothermia, there was no cognitive dissonance. That makes complete sense. This is a dose-finding study to see, really, do we need the degree of hypothermia the original study said, or don't we? And so when I heard this, I'm like, I'd be very interested to see the result of that. This is not in conflict with my belief and my recommendation for an entire city to adopt induced hypothermia. And when the results showed there was no difference between 36 and 33, I didn't have to radically revise my belief structure. It fits in perfectly. When I was recommending early goal-directed therapy, it's because it was, to my mind at the time, the best structure for the resuscitation of these patients out there. And over the years, when we found non-invasive techniques to, in my mind, accomplish the same thing, it wasn't a destruction of the existing beliefs in early goal-directed therapy. It was an evolution. And when the process trial came out and said we could get away with these non-invasive techniques, again, it wasn't a revelation. It was a confirmation. And further, when the process trial showed that early goal-directed therapy wasn't harmful, that it wasn't killing patients, it just maybe wasn't necessary to do all those invasive things, that was a vindication. That's how new evidence should be received if you are an early adopter. It should be received not as a total 180-degree shift in your beliefs, because you should have been right there with the creation of that new evidence. You should be following throughout the developments that led to that new evidence if you want to be an early adopter. If you're an early adopter who's consistently shifting their viewpoint radically, maybe you should slide on over to the middle of the bell curve. You're not doing your job. You're not reading enough. You're not trying enough. You're not engaging in enough to have the Bayesian foundation that will allow you to approach new ideas. Slide back to the middle of the curve. Now, very early in the lecture, Simon harkens back to my talk earlier in the same day, the intra-rest talk, where I recommend that if you already are giving epinephrine, if you believe in giving epinephrine, you probably should give vasopressin and steroids as well. Now, that recommendation was based on my pre-existing analysis of the literature showing intimations of goodness for vasopressin, and then two RCTs with patient-important outcomes showing that vasopressin in addition to epinephrine improved those outcomes. That's not early adoption. I almost think that that's already at the point where early majority should be adopting it. Two RCTs, I almost promise it'll be out in the next ILCOR and AHA guidelines. So I'm not sure why that's a good example. Now, contrast that with Simon's accusation that I would be someone who would use flecainide for acute myocardial infarction, and therefore my early adoption of that therapy would lead to patients dying. And of course, I would never recommend flecainide for two reasons. One, I have no Bayesian belief structure that flecainide would be good. And two, the trial that would lead to this new innovation used a disease-oriented outcome that I would never recommend. Now, my circumstance is a little unique because I don't get to backtrack on my views. I have 4 years of podcasts out there discussing my belief structure at the time. And I can't go back and say I've never said that because I have audiographic evidence of what I said. And in the 4 years I've been doing this, I haven't had to go back and edit or delete any of the existing podcasts because I feel you can be an early adopter and not turn out to be grievously wrong. But if you want to be, you need to put in the time, you need to read, you need to understand how to critically appraise new evidence, how to integrate it into your existing belief structure, how to then test that based on bedside clinical experience, based on your understanding of physiology, based on the specifics of every individual patient. And that's what you need to do if you want to be an innovator or an early adopter. If you don't want to put the time in to do that, that's okay. But then don't be an early adopter. Be the early majority. Be there after it's become to the point where the adoption should happen, where guidelines have been written, where people you respect are saying this therapy is good, it's been vetted, it's been tested. don't be the late majority. The late majority are the people that don't really understand how to work a new idea or technology. They need someone to spoon feed it to them. If you're at the point of late majority in your career, you're probably failing. It may be time to consider getting out. When you no longer could work the new iteration of the iPhone, that's a sign. Something's going on here. You're no longer ready for the technology. It doesn't mean we should put our grandparents on a boat and set it aflame, but it means that in our minds, at least, they're not ready for new technology. Don't be the late majority. Simon, your wife's not the late majority. She's the early majority. She's waiting till someone at a national meeting says this is good. That's the point of early majority adoption. She's right where she should be. And Simon, you're an early adopter for most things, whether you choose to admit it or not. And please, don't be a laggard. Don't be someone who discovered something 15 years ago and it was good, but then you held on to that same idea with no evolution for 15 years because you just want to guard your creation, evolve, allow new ideas and innovations to adapt and change the ideas you hold in your head. That's the only way to be a good clinician. All right, I think I'll leave it there. Maybe Simon will respond. Maybe Simon, we could talk in a two-way communication about this. I think both of us are very interested in these ideas. And as always, my friend, I love listening to you. I love that you make me think. And until next time, this is Scott Weingart for the MCrit Podcast saying bye-bye.